I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Brewster is home to some 80 ponds covering more acreage than any other town on the Cape. Brewster, of course, is not the only town concerned about the growing problem of bacterial contamination, excessive nutrients, invasive species, and the impacts of human development. Joining us to talk about assessing the health of area ponds and challenges to pond restoration is Susan Levin. She's a Brewster town planner. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chris Miller's director of the Brewster Department of Natural Resources. Good morning to you, Chris.
Good morning.
Joining us on the phone, Tom Cambereri, the Watershed Management Director at the Cape Cod Commission. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Mark Nelson joins us on the phone with the Horsley-Witten Group. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So we hear a lot about the nitrogen loads in our estuaries, but the nutrient causing the problem in the ponds is phosphorus, right? So where does this come from?
Phosphorus comes from a number of sources. It's a basic elemental nutrient, and it is basically contained in all the foods that we eat and in all plant matter as well. So when you think about the issues of nutrients, one of the primary sources is septic systems, because a lot of our waste material goes through septic systems and gets into the groundwater. And then also there's road runoff, which is another source of phosphorus, and another key one is fertilization. So fertilizer, if you're looking to stimulate plant growth, you're going to be adding nutrients, or that's been the, typically what happens, and so you're adding a nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium mixture to the ground. So all these sources are ways in which phosphorus is brought to the Cape and deposited onto the land surface in all different manners and getting into groundwater and surface waters.
Hmm. Chris, 80 ponds, that's a lot of ponds to be looking at. So in a second, I'm going to ask Mark how you assess the ponds. But when you look at these 80 ponds, I would imagine you've got varying degrees of the health of the ponds. Some are probably in pretty good shape. Some not so good. Is that how it works?
Definitely. Yeah. And some of the ones that aren't in such good shape are surprising because they're surrounded by undeveloped land, land that we've preserved or hasn't had much human impact on. So it's a puzzle, mm-hmm. definitely.
Yeah. So, Mark, how do you go about assessing the ponds? How's that done?
Well, it's a lot you can tell just by looking at a pond in the summer and looking at the extent of algae that's growing within the water column. But to really understand it, you need to test the quality of the water and measure the phosphorus concentration, both at the surface and down deep near the bottom of the pond. You need to test the sediments to understand how much phosphorus gets trapped in the sediment over time, because it will re-release and come back up into the water column and affect water quality. And then you need to look at the watershed, those areas that contribute groundwater and surface water into a pond, and understand what are the sources that Tom listed out, mm-hmm. and how many septic systems are there, where is there drainage from roads that come straight into the pond, and where are there lawn areas or open areas that have been cleared where fertilizers and vegetation and other things can wash down into the pond, and basically come up with a budget. How much phosphorus is coming in compared to how much phosphorus the pond itself can withstand without having water quality issues.
Tom, you've looked, of course, not working just in Brewster ponds, but there are ponds across the Cape. And you had this 208 program. There's what, 32 shared watersheds. You looked at what, like 996 ponds, right?
Yes. The 208 program that we had just completed last year, we're beginning implementation of that, dealt with 53 coastal embayments and their watersheds. And as we look at this issue of coastal marine water quality issues, we need to look at the entire watershed. And when we look in the watershed, besides houses and development and roads and things like that, and protected open space, that we find many, many surface water bodies or ponds, kettle hole ponds. And there's over 1,000 of these surface water bodies dotted here and there across the Cape. When we say 1,000, maybe 500 of them are greater than 2 acres. So we have a lot of little tiny ones and vernal pools and things like that, and little ponds associated with bogs. But you know, over 2 acres, it's a notable piece of the landscape, and we have of those about 165 are noted as great ponds or ponds over 10 acres. So there is a vast number of surface water ponds on the Cape. Part of our 208 program was to look at evaluating the efforts and the work that had been done on the ponds over the last number of decades, and to integrate that with a way forward and a process for evaluating ponds, their position in the watersheds, how they function, and what attributes they bring into the whole issue of nutrient and water resource management on the Cape.
When did that start, that 208 program? How long ago did you start that?
The initial 208 plan started in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
That plan was finished in 1978, and we had a long period of time where we implemented the recommendations of that, primarily dealing with water quality, and also a big effort was done on pond water quality as well. So over the period of time, there's been a number of efforts. I think the most notable was the first PALS pond workshop. So that was in 2001, and we got a grant. There was a number of folks dealing with ponds, and we used to get together in rooms and try to figure out how to put together a monitoring network for the Cape in for all the variety of water resources, and it was evident that there was great interest in ponds, not only from town officials and various different agencies, but the people themselves that lived around the ponds. Mm-hmm. And so when we had our first pond watershed meeting, it was amazing. The number of people that came out and the interest, and we basically been building on that, and these people that are part of that live near the ponds and they have ponds in their blood are just very enthusiastic about it. They're very dedicated, and we've done a variety of different efforts over the last decade and a half.
One of the things, Tom, I watched a presentation that you did where you talked about this and the fact that back in 2001 you had all 15 towns participating, and that kind of and over the years that sort of dropped off. About 2009 we see fewer towns participating. Do we know why that is? Is it a matter of the resources or why they've dropped off?
Yeah, it's interesting, Mindy. So we began with a bang with 15 towns, and our first sampling protocols that we set up and opportunities for people to sample and get their water quality analyzed through the School of Marine Science and Technology at UMass Dartmouth for free. There was 15 towns, 200 ponds, and over the first time it was over 450 samples that were done. And now, as you noted, the participation in the PALS is actually fairly steady now, with about 7 towns, 100 ponds being monitored, and nearly 300 samples. So maybe the number of ponds and the towns have gone down, but the number of samples only dropped by a quarter. So it's just as if the work is getting kind of more intensive for those towns that are continuing this level of effort. And I know around the table I'm not there, but having Sue, Chris, and Mark and the work, great work that they've done at Brewster, and in cooperation with Orleans and East Ham and Dennis and the town of Barnstable, those are some of the big freshwater pond monitoring towns out there.
Yeah, Sue?
Well, I was going to add to what Tom had said about the interest people have in this and the commitment of the pond people. I call them the pond people. We did a general information meeting on ponds a couple of Januaries ago and really weren't sure what to expect. And we ended up, and this was in January on a Saturday morning, and got over 100 people. Mm. And we had people online who were following it. It was really pretty amazing. And there's I think our joke was that it's really kind of incredible to get that many people in a room who are in a good mood. and what came out of that, which was also fabulous, was the Brewster Ponds Coalition. We had a small group of people who, you know, one from one pond, one from another pond, who were like, well, it would be really great if we could have a group that follows all this and that can provide information to the public and do and kind of promote the work of keeping ponds healthy. And it went from just a small group to what's now an actual not-for-profit. Mm-hmm. And it's fabulous. And they've been very helpful to us in terms of reading proposed regulations and giving us their input. And they've done a lot of outreach. They've run educational programs.
And they have a fabulous website. And we're going to put a link up on our website so folks can check that out at capeandislands.org. Lots of great information. Mm-hmm. So I want you brought this book of maps here that has some, not all of the ponds, but most of the ponds. And explain what those maps are and what information people can get from that.
It's called the Water Resource Atlas, Freshwater Ponds, Brewster, Massachusetts, and it was done by Horsley Witten for us. And a lot of the what goes on in ponds is a matter of where you are in relation to where groundwater is flowing in, and where what goes into the ponds, where things come from. And this atlas is a fabulous piece of information that allows people to look at their ponds and get a better idea of the natural process that's going on in terms of what has impact on the pond, who's up gradient, who's down gradient, who's in the surface watershed, who's in the ground watershed. And the other thing is we're looking at changing some septic regulations that would require specific actions from people who are up gradient, 300 feet up gradient or 100 feet down gradient of a pond. And we found that this became a very popular document when everyone would come in to find out where their house is.
Yeah. Okay, where am I on this map?
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't know, this is a question maybe for Mark or Chris, but when we're looking at the kettle hole ponds, they don't have water flowing in or out, right? So I would imagine this is a challenge if you start to see some, kind of problems in a kettle pond that can escalate pretty quickly, right?
Yeah. In general, most of the Cape Cod ponds don't have streams that lead in or out. They're, like you said, a kettle hole. The water flow is coming from the surface or it's the groundwater flow itself. We often talk about ponds as a window on the watershed. That is your drinking water supply that's sticking out of the ground there, and mm-hmm. that's how we should treat it. This is a very important resource for Cape Cod. It's a sole source aquifer. We don't have any other source of water if we end up with issues in this water.
Yeah. Mark, do you want to chime in there?
Well, I think, too, that's one of the reasons we see phosphorus buildup in many of these ponds, that we have the sources within the watershed that's contributing the phosphorus to the pond, and there's no outlet. It doesn't flow back out through groundwater, and there's no stream for it to wash out either. So we get a buildup over time of phosphorus in the sediment, and that's, as Chris was saying, some of these ponds are impaired, and it's puzzling to know why. And it could be from historical uses around the watershed that could go back 50 years or 100 years. Mm-hmm. And we have just a growing amount of this pollutant that's affecting water quality with no good way to get rid of it.
Yeah, and when you talk about the historical uses around the ponds, so it took a long time in many cases for some of this to affect the quality of the pond, but also it takes a while it takes a while to improve that as well.
That's correct. Yeah. And it's not that much phosphorus that creates the problem. There was a great example written for a pond in Harwich that showed that the amount of phosphorus coming in 1 year was the equivalent to a 5-gallon bucket of phosphorus into a pond that was 20 or 30 acres.
Wow.
So it's a very small amount, and preventing that from coming in is critically important, and it's a challenge to get it out.
Yeah. So
the other thing to keep in mind is that for some of these ponds, stormwater is going directly into them. I have reviewed plans over my career in Brewster, and you look at it, and it says catch basin, and then there's an arrow, and it says drains to pond. And that's the way it used to be done. And there are a lot of places where that's still done, or where over time there's just the low point and then it runs off the low point and it goes to the nearest, you know, body of water. So not only are you getting what's happening at people's houses
and more houses
and plants and the phosphorus that just comes up from the pond itself, there's also pollutants that come into the pond in some cases every time it rains.
We are talking about the health of area ponds and challenges to pond restoration. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join our conversation. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the health of area ponds and challenges to pond restoration with Sue Levin, Brewster Town Manager, Chris Miller, Director of the Brewster Department of Natural Resources. On the phone, Tom Cabareri, from the Watershed Management Director at Cape Cod Commission, and Mark Nelson with the Horsley Witten Group. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you'd like to chime in. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we've talked about some of these problems facing the ponds, the excessive nutrients coming from septic systems, storm runoff, fertilizers, geese can be a problem too, right? What about contaminants of emerging concern? Tom, this is something I know that you've been sort of looking at. Where are we? What are we finding in our ponds?
Yeah, well, I've been close to the researchers at the Silent Spring Institute, and you know, the folks that are actually has done some work looking at the presence of CECs, these compounds of emerging concern, which, you know, we've referred to as, you know, pharmaceuticals, personal care products, things that, you know, ordinarily we don't think of as contaminants, but, you know, just by, you know, drinking and excreting coffee, taking painkillers, acetaminophen, and you know, dealing washing clothes with you know, fire retardants on them and things like that. Well, where does all that go? It goes into the septic systems for most of Cape Cod, which releases these compounds in small quantities or small concentrations to the groundwater. And so, you know, the whole field of compounds of emerging concern are these you know, laboratory ability to detect these compounds in smaller and smaller trace and concentrations. And so we find that they don't go away, but they are prevalent. Some of them get attenuated in that. So I want to say that they're all don't get attenuated, but there are a number of them that persist and go from the septic system to groundwater and flow in groundwater to a downgradient receptor. And you know, downgradient receptor could be a pond, private well, public supply well, and or discharge out to the marine waters. And the research on the ponds did find low concentrations of a number of these CECs, compounds of emerging concern. And what the control, the way the work was done was they looked at ponds that were, let's say, well protected, that had a lot of open space around them, less dense housing, and they compared that to water quality in ponds that were down gradient of more highly dense development. Yep. Residential development for the most part. And, you know, like we see in a lot of places, there is a relationship between housing density and water quality impacts. And this is, you know, what they found in the ponds as well. So there are these concentrations in the ponds. And also, you know, just to add on to that, the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies is doing work out in Nantucket Sound and in some of our embayments. Mm-hmm. And they, too, are finding these small concentrations. What we don't know is you know, what the impacts are to both the ecosystems, the plant and animal populations in the ponds, and many of these compounds, what the human health impact is. So we're really on the tip of the iceberg on this.
Yeah, and of course, mixing them. What happens when you mix one compound with another? We don't really know the answer to some of that. So this kind of comes back to that education component, because there are things we can do to lessen that, and letting people know, you know, don't flush your excess medicine down the toilet, and, you know,
We've really tried to get information out as much as possible to people, and it's interesting. We've done it a lot of different ways. We went to the Lower Cape Expo. It's like a home show, and people come up to the table. They're like, "Why are you here?" But it's and well, we're not from Brewster. I'm like, it doesn't matter. Take whatever you want. The information is important to everyone. We have a lot of information available in Town Hall. We have actually a water planning website that you can access off the town's website that pretty much has every word that's ever been written on most of this for Brewster. And we really try to get things out to people in an understandable fashion. We decided a long time ago that people don't need to know the difference between, eutrophic, mesotrophic, mm-hmm. and oligotrophic, but they need to know their pond is dirty.
Right.
And they need to know what it is that makes it that way and what they can do. And one of the important things that's happening now is while there are large projects that the town can take on and that will improve the health of the ponds, it really is going to become and has always been the responsibility of each individual homeowner to manage those things on their own property that can contribute to the health of their ponds.
Yeah. Chris, we mentioned we have some towns that have active citizen participation in Brewster. As we mentioned, we have the nonprofit Brewster Ponds Coalition. I would imagine that's very helpful for towns who are trying to improve water quality to have this active group that's not only getting information out to other people, but is participating in some of like the quality sampling and things like that, right?
Yeah, they've been tremendously happy, helpful with what we're doing. They've been happy to help us whenever we're trying to gather volunteers. We have, like Tom was saying, a large active pond and lake steward group that helps us take our water quality samples. We sample 29 ponds twice a year. And it's once in the spring, once in the fall. So some people are here in the fall, some people aren't here in the spring. So we need a lot more than 29 people to help us do this. Mm. And they've been very good at getting the word out. And those people are usually the pond advocates. If you live on the pond, you become the expert. People come, all your neighbors come to you and ask you, what's the health of our pond? How are we doing? So that group has really helped us a lot with getting the outreach.
Do all 80 ponds get tested?
No. We try to go mostly to our great ponds. Great ponds are 10 acres or more, and you know we have 29 uh-huh. that we're dealing with. So that's a good proportion, and they vary. Some of them are over in Nickerson State Park, for example.
Right. Tom, what's the commission's role in this?
Well, we are looking at through our 208 plan. We have set out a process for dealing with. Gaining broad input for making water resource decisions for dealing with the coastal water quality issue, as well as the freshwater pond issue. So, what we're looking at now is a program. We have a lot of these. We have a lot of pond group monitoring groups out there, many times what we hear is. We need. We're generating a lot of data. What does the data mean? And so, we're trying to come up with different protocols for monitoring. So we have the monitoring data. It needs to be interpreted. The data needs to be submitted in a more formal way to DEP. DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection. We need to have some sit-down discussions with them as to the role of the citizen monitoring in regards to the regulatory program that is set up to evaluate and designate impaired water quality, surface water quality bodies. So there were some back and forth discussion about the role of water. Citizen water quality data, which we believe here is valid and taken under the correct protocols and should be used to regulatory right. determination. The other thing is we mentioned data management and that, and it's in talking to the folks and the Brewster Pond Coalition and Orleans and East Ham is there. We're working with some folks in putting together what a data template would be data. So if we can, if we have a kind of a uniform data template for a lot of this data, then the interpretation of it can be a lot more straightforward. And so we were, you know, looking for some grant funds to do this, but we found a person in Orleans who's got real interesting background, who's taken on a lot of the data, and so we're working with him on that. But we'll continue to try to pull this together in concert with the work that we're doing on the embayments to pull together a data management in our warehouse service. In a regional sense, so that this information is available. For instance, we just pulled together a website. It's on our website. It's called Pond Projects on our CapeCodCommission.org website. And we were able to catalog about 17 pond water restoration efforts. And, you know, as folks were going through these restoration efforts, everybody would say, well, what has everybody else done? What is the technology that has worked for one pond? Would it work for our pond? And so we're just kind of at the tip of the iceberg putting together, you know, more assembling this data so it is accessible.
That'll be useful, yeah.
To the public.
Sue?
One of the things that we've tried to encourage people to do is when you think about a great pond, it's 10 acres, you have your subdivision on this side, and there could be two or three others as you go around. And it kind of gives a little new meaning to across the pond,
right.
because the people who live on one side don't really know the people who live on the other side. And in a lot of cases in Brewster, a lot of these ponds are almost completely privately owned.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of need for all these people to kind of get together. And I know one of the ponds has, they have a cookout and a yard sale, you know, and that's how everyone gets to know each other. And it's going to be important moving forward for everyone to literally get to know their neighbors.
Right.
Because...
Yeah. Right, because you're going to play, it's those guys across the pond, it's not us.
Yeah. Right, and also the fact that if you're looking at a project that's going to involve hiring a consultant or doing specific work, everybody's going to have to be involved in that. And the hope is that, and people for the most part have been really positive about doing things to improve their ponds.
Well, if you're living on a pond, you want the water quality to be good.
Absolutely.
Mark, I wanted to ask you, Tom touched on technology and what other people are doing, and that's an area I know that you would be very familiar with. And I imagine a lot of the data that Tom was talking about is something that you also have, right?
Right, and it's helpful to have all that. You need to have a clear picture of the quality of the pond to figure out how you're going to work on a restoration plan. And there are ways to restore a pond by looking at dealing with the sediments at the pond bottom. And it's also what we manage within the watershed to prevent further phosphorus from coming in. And I'll just give you one example with the idea of emerging contaminants. We've been developing a regulation for septic systems that when a home has to upgrade their septic system or they're going for an expansion, that they would design a leach field that was very shallow in the soil, very close to the ground surface, perhaps 6 inches to 12 to 18 inches below the ground surface, where the soil itself, the iron in the soil, is very effective at binding up the phosphorus that's there and can really minimize, if not eliminate, the septic system is a source of phosphorus to a pond. And the ancillary benefit of that we've been learning from research being done by the county through George Hoyfelder, the county health director, is showing that those same soil systems can be incredibly effective at removing the contaminants of emerging concern.
Hmm.
That the bacteria and the life within that upper soil layer feeds on those contaminant food and can break them down and prevent them from moving further down into the ground and out towards the pond.
Yes, the things we learn as we go along. So, so what's the role of ponds in watershed management plans?
In Brewster, part of what we did was what they call an integrated water resources management plan. And that looks not only at embayments and at sewering, which is what a lot of them do, because Brewster actually, I hope, is not going to have to sewer. It looks at all water, at surface water, groundwater, at drinking water supply, at a little bit of everything. And in truth, it all kind of comes together. Anyway, if there's something wrong with your ponds, there's going to be something wrong other places. If your stormwater ends up, for example, going out onto a beach untreated, you're going to have issues at the beach. Mm-hmm. So everything is all woven. So, and particularly for ponds, partly because Brewster has a very strong tourism economy, and people rent their houses. People want to buy houses next to a pond, and it's important to be able to preserve the all the uses of the pond. If someone wants to canoe on it, if someone wants to swim in it, that if you can't do that, or if it becomes what I think I've heard called an aesthetic pond or a view pond, which means you can look at it, but you can't really do anything with it.
Right.
It becomes an issue overall that is kind of the tip of the iceberg of a lot of economic problems.
Yeah. So now, there's a proposed bylaw, a change at Springtown meeting that has to do with storm runoff. Is that right? And there's a public hearing coming. I might want to mention that now.
Yes. We're putting forward a stormwater management bylaw, and It has two parts to it. There is a portion that applies to single and two-family residences and a part that applies to commercial, industrial, and multifamily developments. A lot of the larger developments already address stormwater as part of their review process. For single and two-family homes, they may very well do that also. But what we're doing is asking for a little bit more quantification. If you're disturbing more than 2,500 square feet of land, which would be putting in a house, pool, tennis court, it would require you to show how you're going to manage the stormwater that is added by these changes to the property. And for homeowners, it could be as simple as saying, I'm going to take my downspouts and put them into dry wells, or I'm going to have pervious paving in my driveway. And for larger developments, there may be more complex solutions. But in the end, the main thing is that all the stormwater stays on your property, that it doesn't run off into the street, into municipal storm drains where they really aren't supposed to be, or into private storm drains on roads.
And so there's a public hearing on March 9th?
Yes, there's a public hearing at Brewster Town Hall on March 9th at 6:30. And also the copies of the bylaw, and there's a set of code amendments. What we're doing is, instead of having separate discussions of stormwater in half a dozen places between the bylaws, subdivision regulations, and zoning, we're basically taking all of that and referring it back to the stormwater bylaw, so everyone will be working with the same set of information. And that's out on the town's website. It should be on the homepage.
All right. We're talking about the health of area ponds and challenges to pond restoration. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the health of area ponds and challenges to pond restoration with Sue Levin, Brewster Town Planner, Chris Miller, Director of the Brewster Department of Natural Resources, on the phone, Tom Cambereri, Watershed Management Director at the Cape Cod Commission, and Mark Nelson with the Horsley-Witten Group. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to chime in. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So pond restoration costs money. And those resources are not easy to come by, since we're not the only thing. We have the estuaries, which seem to get most of the focus right now. So what are some of the other challenges to cleaning up their ponds? Is there some like permitting things that stand in the way? What makes this such a challenge?
Yeah, there certainly is a lot of permitting. Obviously, the Wetlands Protection Act, all of the ponds are surrounded by wetlands, and they are itself a resource area. So you have to go through the state. There's also natural heritage that looks at the threatened or endangered species that may be in the ponds. So there's, you know, a long regulatory path to go down. But it has been done before. Back in 2007, Brewster treated Long Pond with an alum treatment along with the town of Harwich. That's the biggest pond on Cape Cod. I think it was a $500,000 project that we managed to find some grant funds for. Mm-hmm. We've been monitoring it since. It's been very successful. It's really improved water clarity and locked up a lot of the alum, has locked up a lot of the phosphorus into the sediments.
Yeah. Now, is that a little bit controversial, the alum?
Obviously putting chemicals into a water body certainly is something that we're going to study very carefully and make sure we know what we're doing. It's been done quite a bit. This mm-hmm. one was done. We didn't have any fish kills or any death to mussels or anything like that.
So, and you would be looking at it wouldn't be the answer for all the ponds. It would be some ponds that's a proper way to go.
Yeah, and again, it's a treatment. It's mm-hmm. not a cure. It right. locks the sediments up for a time, but it doesn't mean that those nutrients won't eventually recycle back into the water supply. We're hoping that we can get a 15 to 20 year life out of a treatment like that. I know Cliff Pond in Nickerson State Park is going to be treated with alum this coming spring and fall by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation, for example.
So,
yes, I think it's important for people to understand that an alum treatment is not the instant cure that's going to make it fabulous forever. It basically brings you back to zero or somewhere near there. And then everything that's coming into the pond still comes into the pond. And so it's a combination of doing that kind of treatment and then educating the homeowners and people who use the pond to make sure that what comes back into the pond slows considerably and it extends the life of the treatment. Otherwise, you're just kind of
putting a Band-Aid on it.
Putting a Band-Aid on it, yeah, and it doesn't last as long.
Yeah, Mark, do you have any thoughts on challenges to restoration, pond restoration?
Well, I was going to say that the alum approach really is a Band-Aid, as you said, and the ultimate solution has to come from changes in practices within the watershed. So it's like moving a septic system leach field so it can no longer contribute phosphorus, or restoring, retrofitting stormwater that's heading straight to the pond right as the rain begins and treating that water before it gets in, and also encouraging homeowners to build a vegetated buffer along the shoreline. And, you know, that doesn't happen as much with new construction these days, but in the past, people would have a lawn that would go straight down to their beach, and all the leaf litter, any runoff from their compost pile, we've been finding from research that that's one of the significant sources of phosphorus. And if you can build a vegetated buffer along the shore of the pond, you can trap that vegetated debris and get that phosphorus to go into the soil as opposed to into the pond.
Mm. Go ahead, Sue.
One of the things that we had talked about doing was getting in touch with some of the local garden centers and things to have an area that's has a collection of plants, and this is your buffer, and it's this large and this mm-hmm. wide, and then what each plant is and easier access to them, so that somebody who wants to do this isn't walking into it kind of blind.
Yeah. Tom, do you have thoughts on challenges to pond restoration?
Yes. Well, you know, we've covered a lot of ground and made a lot of great progress in the way that we do these ponds. I mentioned that we have like 17 pond restoration projects, and the project that Sue and Chris were talking about, Long Pond, that's shared, you know, one of the biggest ponds, you know, on Cape Cod, over 740 some odd acres. When they did that treatment, it was a long process of evaluating that chosen technology, getting buy-in. It had only been done once before on the Cape early on in the 90s, and the implementation of it didn't go quite the way that they wanted to. It had results, but so there was a lot of fear, angst about it, but the just pulling together the resources that were available. I think it was actually an earmark from the state legislature to help pass and pull that together. Cape Wildcat Commission was involved with that in obtaining 319 grant funds for it. So it really kind of opened the door because it was a successful alum treatment that for some of these large deep ponds is the most kind of economical way to go in getting out that phosphorus, or not getting it out, but capping the phosphorus at the bottom of the ponds. And so now that's been done a number of places, and I think where it's necessary as a remediation, it's more straightforward. So we've covered a lot of ground under that. So it's surprising when you think about Cliff Pond, also one of the largest ponds on the Cape, having these algae blooms on it and the presence of cyanobacteria. I've gone camping up there many years with my family, and so you go up there and geez, the pond is closed to swimming. How could that be? It's in the middle of Nickerson State Park. So we've been kind of waiting for this restoration project to happen up at Cliff Pond that the DCR is going to be undertaken. And key in say that the backyard solutions and the local regulatory solutions that Sue and Mark and Chris had talked about are essential tools for keeping pond water quality in check.
Yeah.
Even after some of these restoration projects, and certainly for other ponds that are shallow and have different types of strategies for their restoration,
And so, as you're mentioning, if homeowners, there's a lot of things homeowners can do, and if as you're talking, and we heard what Mark said about the amount of phosphorus, it's not a large amount. So if you can stop that in these yards, that would be a big improvement to the water quality, right?
Yes, and there are a lot of things that people can do, like the vegetated buffers, that aren't incredibly expensive. They're not, it's not like you build a wall that's 10 feet deep and 10 feet high between you and the pond.
Right.
It's very simple things that that you and your neighbors could get involved in together and make it a buffer day and plant everybody's yard. The other thing that I was thinking about, which is not so much about the phosphorus issue, is especially with larger ponds that take larger boats, is and people who are trailering boats from other parts of the country, not only just other parts of the Cape, is to know where your boat's been and what you may be bringing.
Invasives.
To, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To you're reading my
pond.
Mind. That was my next thing I was going to bring up is, what about these invasive? Because it's true, you don't mean to. You've got even your kayak, and you're going from pond to pond. I know Tom kayaks in different ponds, and just knowing that you could have something on your, like you say, your trailer, your boat, and putting it at that could be, and that's caused some real problems in some ponds.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the invasives that we're really concerned about?
Well, obviously there's different plants that can outcompete some of the native plants, especially when there's a lot of fertilizer in there. We've been fortunate in Brewster. It's not a huge issue yet. I think our biggest concern is we have a number of boat ramps, and even the fishermen may bring in, some minnows and bait and have a little bit of plant in there with it. And at the end of the day, they just dump it in the pond. We don't know where these came from.
Right.
We don't know what's being introduced here. So they just need to keep it in mind that it's not always better to do that kind of thing.
All right. And maybe this is a question for Mark. Are there septic designs that could help as we're moving forward?
There definitely are. There's a couple of systems that have been approved in Massachusetts that actually treat phosphorus prior to it being discharged out to a leach field. And both are in what they call a pilot stage. So they're still relatively new and they're still being field tested, but they look very promising. One basically uses iron to trap the phosphorus in the septic tank so it doesn't flow down into groundwater. And then the other thing, as I mentioned earlier, is just how we design our leach field. We can take advantage of the natural sediments that are in the subsoil to trap phosphorus. And with that, also make sure we're siting a leach field as far from the upgradient shore of the pond as possible on a lot. If we're more than 300 feet away from the pond, or if we're high up on a hill it's less likely that the phosphorus is going to make it down to the pond.
Maybe this is a question for you, Chris. I'm sure there are folks say, you know, ponds are protected under the Clean Water Act, too, and we're focusing on the estuaries. What about my pond? What do you tell people who come to you with that problem?
Well, I think in Brewster, you know, the estuary that we have of concern is Pleasant Bay, and we have 40 foot of town frontage on Pleasant Bay. So it's hard to get the townspeople really excited about cleaning up Pleasant Bay. But if you look at the properties in town, some of the most beautiful properties are on our ponds. You know, we have so much frontage on it and so many homes and people there. One of the nice advantages is if we clean up the areas around the pond, it's going to help the estuaries. The groundwater flow regionally flows by the ponds and out into this. So anything that that remediates a pond is in the long term going to help the ocean mm-hmm. and the estuary surrounding it. So that's what we really focus on.
Yeah. Tom, do you get that question? I know because really the money right now seems to be focused on estuary cleanup and not ponds. Are ponds somewhere down there on the list eventually?
I think ponds are on the list. We get the question a lot, mostly from pond people, saying, you know, what about the ponds? And we're focusing so much on the nutrient issue of nitrogen and coastal water quality issues. But the ponds, as you know, Chris said and I mentioned before, you know, part of the landscape, part of the watersheds, and so the better manage the nutrients in the watershed that affect the coastal water quality. We need to pay attention to how the ponds are functioning and their water quality. So the ponds are an essential part of our water resources here connected to the aquifer, and I think our support for local and regional efforts is there. We've talked about them in the 208 plan, where we've basically have maybe 30% of the ponds in an okay shape, maybe 20% of them are in an impaired condition, and another 20% are in what we call a good condition or oligotrophic. But then we have 31% of these ponds that we have data for that we haven't interpreted yet, and I think that's where we're going to try to focus our efforts and where we're moving forward to implement the 208 plan is how can we get resources dispersed and better have better ways to assemble, compile, and interpret the data and have information more accessible.
Right. So I'm going to just jump in. We have like a minute left. Sue, you wanted to add something real quick?
One of the things we've been looking at in Brewster, and I'm not sure how we put it together, we have something called road betterments. So if you have a private road that needs to be repaired, the town can step in and basically become the general contractor and have the work done. And there's a way to add it to the tax bill of the surrounding neighbors. So we thought about the idea of doing a pond betterment, where if the people who surround a pond want to be able to do their work, but they don't want to get into chasing people for money, that we could put something together that would work in a similar fashion.
What a great idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I apologize for people trying to call in. I understand we're having some problems with our phones this morning. So if you've been trying to call in and haven't been successful, we apologize for that. Do want to mention that there is a Healthy Pond Art Festival coming up Saturday, March 12th at the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History. This is being put on by the Brewster's Pond Coalition. From 11 to 2, the theme of the festival, What is a Healthy Pond? All kinds of artwork as well as hands-on activities. I want to thank the Brewster Ponds Coalition for even suggesting the topic for today's program. Sue Levin, Brewster Town Planner, Chris Miller, Director of the Brewster Department of Natural Resources, Tom Cambereri, Watershed Management Director at the Cape Cod Commission, and Mark Nelson with the Horsley-Witten Group. Thank you all for taking time to be with us this morning. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point with production assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.